Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York and California. And we're sitting in lovely Bushwick, Brooklyn at heritageradionetwork.org. And today my guest is Joaquin Baca. He didn't have to come very far. He is the executive chef and co-owner of Brooklyn Star right here in Brooklyn. And before that, he was at the Rusty Knot, where he was the executive chef in Manhattan. And before that, he was the 2007 James Beard Award winner for Best New Restaurant as co-chef and co-owner of the famous Sambar. Joaquin has a degree in photojournalism from the University of Texas, and he's lived all over the world, but spent 10 years cooking in the Southwest before coming to New York. So he's got a fascinating background. Welcome, Joaquin. So happy you could make it here today.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for having me.
Ooh, nice voice on the radio. Okay, let's tell our listeners about your background and all the countries you lived in, and why were you bopping around the world?
Fortunately, my parents decided that they wanted to raise their kids outside of the country. So from the time we were about a year old, they joined the Peace Corps. And then segued that into State Department. So we moved to Colombia first, and then State Department, and so it was Mexico and Portugal.
So you were born in Texas?
Born in San Francisco, actually.
Oh, in San Francisco.
Dad was a civil rights lawyer in the 70s.
Uh-huh. And where did they go? I was in the Peace Corps. Where did they go in the Peace Corps?
Bogota.
Oh, Bogota. I've actually been to Bogota. I like Bogota. It's a pretty city.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. That is great. So that's how they got into the State Department. What are your memories of... you were mainly in South and Central America,
right.
But then you did go to the Philippines as well, right?
I spent half of high school in the Philippines and half in Uruguay.
Oh, so. What was that like? Because, wow, talk about two different cultures.
Incredibly different. It's sort of a... kind of lifestyle you just get used to. It seems odd to like to move around so much as a kid, but it's, I mean, you're sort of surrounded by the same, you know, same, everybody's kind of in the same boat. You're going to international school system. Most of the other kids are either U.S. Foreign Service or other, and so you just, doesn't seem weird at all.
Did you go out and eat street food everywhere you were?
Yes, of course. More so when we got to be of age to do so on our own, but also my parents are.
Yes, locals.
Yeah,
they like the local culture.
They're pretty good.
Okay, so when you were a senior in high school, what is it that you had a passion for and thought you were going to be when you grew up?
Girls.
Oh, just gosh, like I set myself up for that one.
I'm sorry, but it's okay. The truth of the matter.
Aside from that.
The early part of high school was in the Philippines, which is a really interesting place for a kid to be at that age. So it was sort of not exactly lawless, but you can kind of get away with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of time was spent exploring not so much food, but culture.
And the girls.
I'm trying to
All right.
Try not to get myself in trouble.
Okay,
here.
All right. Let's keep it clean. What was your favorite food memory from Philippines?
Well, I did have some local friends that would take me to some of the areas I probably wasn't supposed to be in. There's a lot of like probably things that you're not supposed to eat that are meat on sticks. Essentially meat on sticks.
Okay.
And a guy with no shoes and a fire.
I have a feeling you really like the lawless part.
It's something about it. It's kind of heartwarming. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so then you went to Uruguay for the last 2 years of high school?
Yeah. Uruguay is a really beautiful country. It's very, it's sort of very like old European in nature. It's like a coastal city. Looks a lot like Lisbon, in that the whole city follows that main oceanfront highway.
Yeah.
And it's has a lot of leftovers from Italians and Germans. There's a lot of like blonde haired, blue eyed, Spanish speaking people, and it's kind of throws you off at first. And even the Spanish is different. It's Rio Platense is more of like a double L sound like J's. It's kind of like the way that Brazilian is to Portuguese.
Oh.
And food wise, it is
meat.
Yeah, meat. But a lot of, like I said, a lot of Italian influence. There are very few, but there are some Uruguayan restaurants in Manhattan, and actually, there's one in Brooklyn that's really good.
What's
but
that
it's,
one?
Jesus. What it's called right now.
Okay. We'll go to Brooklyn Star and see.
But it's a lot of pastas they have their own style of pizza and stuff too.
Oh, that's great. So, you're a senior in high school. Where are we going to go the next year? I'm trying to get where your head was at when you were.
Well, like most people, I started doing college applications at that point, and and I filled out the first one to University of Texas, which is where my family went, and that was a one-page front and back application with no essay. And before I got around to doing all the other more tedious ones, I went and came back.
You were at Austin. I mean, that's a great.
I love Austin.
I know, that's a great university and a great town.
It is. It's a huge university. It's a huge university town. It's very young. It's very fun. There's a lot of water holes and barbecue, and it was just a really great place. And it's where I had kind of grown up, coming back to when we lived overseas. My mom's family lives in South Texas. So, Austin was pretty much the stopover, and my parents both met at UT. So it's kind of a central point for the whole family.
Well, did you stay? I know your family has a ranch, a 5,000-acre ranch.
Yeah, cattle ranch in South Texas.
How much time did you spend on the ranch?
When you're posted overseas with the State Department, they send you back, depending on where you're posted, they send you back every so often. So it could be a year, every year. It could be every summer, or it can be every couple summers, depending on the...
And you would stay at the ranch?
Yeah.
So are you a wrangler?
I would not.
Can you wrangle?
I'm not sure that's actually a verb, but...
but if you're a wrangler, I guess,
I think that's only on Blazing Saddles.
Oh, a Brooklyn girl. That's about as close as I get to wranglers.
Yes. I ride horses and work cattle and stuff, yes.
Oh, that's neat. Do you really put it together with food, meat, when you're wrangling cattle? Because that's what you're wrangling them for, right?
Yes, you are wrangling them for meat.
But you're probably eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches when you're out on the range, right? Because they fit in your saddlebag.
I really like the image that you have of how it is. It's actually much nicer than the truth.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that'll be another show. I think that Mitchell does shows on okay. that. So tell me, photojournalism. Is there right side, left side, or all right side? Where's your brain? You wanted to be an artist? You wanted to be a photographer taking pictures of models because they're girls?
No, I think I smoked a lot of pot and watched National Geographic, and I thought I wanted to do that. I wanted to be a documentary photographer, and I really enjoyed a large part of it. I did some projects that were really fun for me, but at the end of it, I realized that that sort of separating yourself from something and being totally impartial, it's really difficult to do, and it's like just completely keeping yourself out of a situation.
It
just wasn't something I was able to do very well.
I see. So what did you do after university?
I cooked my way through school for tuition. University of Texas was a good, it's a state university, and in-house tuition is very decent and very manageable. So I don't have any student loans, but it's because I managed to
work.
To work.
So what kind of restaurants were you working in back then?
Oh, I did a lot of like little mom and pop cafe stuff. I worked at a vegetarian restaurant for a year and a half. I did a bunch of random stuff until I.
What was your attitude in those days? Was it just a job and you kind of liked food, or were you really into it and trying to learn?
I didn't really realize how much I loved it until I finished school and it was time for me to cast that aside and go and find a job in my supposed train career, train field.
Right.
But I took immediately to more the work environment at first than the actual... love of food is one thing, but I never really thought I wanted to be a chef. I just really loved being in the kitchen.
So tell me your road to chefdom, because, you know, how do you wind up being co-chef, co-owner with David Chang of Sambar?
I think blind luck, like most of that whole Momofuku. It's a strange trip. So anyways, after Austin, I went to New Mexico for a while, worked there for a few years, and then moved to New York. Trailed at all the places that I really wanted to work.
Like
all the big names that anybody from outside of New York goes to, all the Danielle places. The Frenchy guys. I went to Babbo.
The Italian guy, the Italian American guy.
Sure. Boulay. And I had a bunch of trails that I thought were really fun. And I thought what I was very successful at, but ultimately the one that was most intriguing was this random guy in the East Village, who was, pulling his hair out, but he had this tiny little shoebox that was not even built out yet, and he just needed somebody to help him run it. And I thought, this is a...
How'd you meet David?
Monster.com, I think it was.
Oh, really?
So yeah, totally bizarre.
You were answering an ad?
I was answering an ad. Well, actually, I was answering an ad that a girlfriend told me I had to answer.
Oh, and it was to Sambar.
It was to the original noodle bar. Before Momofuku was a restaurant.
Okay. So tell us about that's fascinating. I think everybody wants to get under the tent on that one. What? How did that come about?
Very clumsy.
All right, that's real.
It's the truth, and Dave will tell you the same. We made a lot of mistakes. We didn't exactly know what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We didn't actually think that we knew what we were doing, but we tried to do it anyways. We went into it with some poorly conceived plans about opening a not authentic but real Japanese style noodle bar. We quickly realized we're not Japanese. I think everybody.
He worked in Japan for a while.
Work in Japan. I don't really think that prepares anybody to be Japanese, though.
No, and doesn't even prepare the Japanese to cook their own noodles.
Correct. So we tripped over our feet for a while before we realized that we were trying to be somebody that we weren't, and finally just gave in to just cooking whatever it is that we wanted to, and that's when we started to find our way, and when people started to think we're less stupid than we had seemed at first.
How long did it take for the press to discover your new...
Probably about...
How long did it take you to stop the original, you know, Japanese thing and do your own thing? And then how long did
it... 6 months, maybe. And then, like, in that first year, we started to get a little love.
And the first 6 months, how many people were coming into the restaurant?
It was dismal.
Okay. And whose money was on the line? David's?
Dave had, I don't know if he wants me telling this, but he had borrowed from family and every credit card and everything he had in the past. So he was all in.
That's the real story for a lot of people there.
Yeah, it was truly terrifying. I worked for somebody a long time ago that told me to make all of your mistakes with somebody else's money.
Yes.
So that's what I was doing. Don't know if that would really count for Dave.
Really? But look, you know what? If you don't risk, you don't get the reward. So then after 6 months, because of the financial pressures, or you guys were just fed up with...
We were just sort of fed up with being ridiculed a little bit. And
who was ridiculing you?
Well, I think anybody who walked by.
Okay. So was it in the press, or were you...
You know, honestly, I don't know. I don't really remember. I think Dave was looking at that more than I was, and I was just trying to operate day to day. And he was getting frustrated because, I mean, I was new to New York, so I didn't, I wasn't like looking at the regular press outlets and internet blog outlets that I sort of like look to now to see who's getting what kind of action. Mm-hmm. So at the time I was sort of had blinders on. All I was doing was operating this little business. And,
how many people in the kitchen back then?
There were about three of us.
And, was Christina's toast?
No, she was after the first year.
After the first year.
She came in as an angel of mercy.
I know. She's been on the show, too. We're getting all different perspectives. And then we're going to get Dave himself in here. And, you know, he can blow up the place.
Good luck. You might have to wrangle.
He is a wrangling type. So tell me, So now you changed the menu, you're doing your own food.
Changed the menu, and we got like a New York Times review, which is Pete Meehan, thought fit to bestow upon us, which pretty much saved our butts.
Is that a two-star?
No. That was 25 and under.
Oh, 25 and under. Yeah.
This was the little 28-seat restaurant in the East Village, and after that point, we started to pack it in pretty good. Mm-hmm. And the most important byproduct of that was that we became somewhere that people actually wanted to work, and we were able to hire the team that really turned us around. Those early three to five years were an amazing class of person went through that kitchen.
Okay, we're going to take a little break here. Okay. And when we come back, we'll talk about the kitchen. Okay.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Joaquin Baca from Brooklyn Star Restaurant, and we're following his journey. And Joaquin was the chef and co-owner of Sambar with David Chang, and we're talking about the early days at Mama Fuca Noodle Bar, or just Noodle Bar in those days.
Mama Fuca Noodle Bar.
Mama Fuca Noodle Bar.
The full working title.
What a mouthful of noodles. And we're talking about it wasn't a raging success out of the box, and it was 25 and under, which was, I guess in the New York Times, if that's a perfect place for a small place
to start.
Because if you got a star or two stars, people's expectations would be there, and it would be harder.
We couldn't have been happier. That's all we wanted was anybody to pat us on the back and say,
right,
you're not terrible.
Okay. So then it starts rocking.
And then,
so how do you decide? So, you know, let's get behind the kitchen door. You're working for David. David's put up all the money. It's David's show. And now he wants to open a second. How does that conversation start with someone like you?
It's pretty much a no-brainer. Somebody says, you want to do another one, and we're having so much fun. How can we not?
So had he had the place picked out, or did you two go walking around the neighborhood?
There was this place that had been a empty Chinese restaurant. It was something Lucky Family Superstar Garden. I can't remember what it was called. But it had been shut down for some sort of lewd behavior looked like near a decade. And I guess he had been in negotiations for a little while before he brought it up. And at that time, we had hired Thick. We had this guy, Kevin Pumoulier, that we had brought from Kraft. He now runs 30 Acres in Jersey City. Doing
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Timmy Maslow was one of our first externs, and he now has Striptease in Boston. And this guy, Scott, we pulled also, who's now about to open his place. Scott Garfinkel is opening Fern Shawarma in Manhattan. So everybody kind of now is on their... We've got this great
and
bunch.
And you have Brooklyn Star.
Right, we've got this great bunch, and this great bunch of people that are from all different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And we're basically just bursting at the seams. We have all these people in this little tiny 28-seat restaurant. So
and they're all wildly talented. Were they all equally experienced, or did they come in and did you see a growth arc there?
We all learned together, it was a great, beautiful, organic explosion.
What did you learn? In that time in that kitchen,
I learned everything that I do know about running and operating a business in New York City, which is different from any other city, I'm sure. But
You can't make statements like that without.
Well, I mean, they're all different. I mean, you could say that about anywhere.
Yeah. But what on the Lower East Side?
It's tough. There are, I mean, I don't want to get into it too much, but there are a lot of hoops that one has to jump through. They're just logistics, right, just to operate in the city. And there's around every corner, there's a surprise of something that you didn't know you even had to fill out,
right,
or a permit you didn't even know you had to have.
Right. I know, the bureaucracy.
I know the ins and outs of some of the New York City bureaucracies that I wish I didn't even know, but
it's
valuable. I think the most important thing that we all learned was what we could accomplish by casting aside the standard hierarchy of one guy in charge and pyramid system. And we kind of went at it with this group shotgun approach where we all just, all menu development from the time of Noodle Bar to Sambar was written in these round table emails. We got everybody Blackberries and we had everybody on these emails that would shoot out, and it would be like somebody's in the, you know, eating Kaiseki at 3 a.m. and they have something great and they're like, oh, I just had this, and then they bounce it off, and then somebody who's drunk and is just being silly like sends back some stuff, and it would just kind of get the ball rolling, and then the next few days things would kind of start to simmer, and then dishes would pop up, and it got it's pretty much how we kept it like really fresh, and it kept it really fun, and everybody got to be involved, everyone from you know, I mean everybody was kind of, there were a lot of sous chefs.
Mm-hmm.
So
that really empowers you, doesn't it?
Really does, and it really inspires you too. It's like competitive in the best kind of way, because it's not like somebody wants to be the last to the finish line. It's this like a baton race or something, you know?
Right, and it really creates team. Is David a good team builder, or
he must be, because things are working out pretty good for everybody. Right. Dave was real smart in hiring a great bunch, and organizing us.
So how is Sambar supposed to be different from Noodle Bar?
So Sambar opens, and Dave's got this idea about this. Sam is the Korean word for a wrap, and he has this idea for a Korean burrito, essentially, which we banged away at for a while. And it didn't work out how we thought it was going to be. We built this place, or Dave built this place, that looked far classier than what we were trying to put out of it. And it only took us a couple of months. Like, again, this is the same process. It took us a few months to realize that we were sort of barking up the wrong tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, we started bringing on more people. We brought on Tin Ho, Johanna Ware, both who have their own place now. Johanna's got her place in Portland, and Tin Ho just opened Montrachet. And so now, again, we've got like even more people packed in this thing. So it was just a matter of letting the reins loose. And then once that happened, it exploded.
So you've got all these very talented cooks in a small kitchen.
Right.
Really having a good time.
Probably too much fun.
Right. But now they've all spun off. So what does it take to leave an environment like that and spin off?
I think everybody does it for different reasons. I mean, the machine outgrew me. It got bigger than what I had aspired to do. And, Dave wanted to expand it more. And, I think a lot of us were just kind of caught up in the mom and pop thing that we had, and we're kind of scared about, you know, graduating middle school and moving on. For me, it was sort of a, I mean, I love Dave. We're pals. We're good. Everything's great. We both realized that, you know, I was holding him back. I wanted to keep things, you know, I was just keep things the way they were, and Dave wanted to move along. Natural progression.
How big is the empire now?
It's pretty huge.
Do you have any idea how many?
I don't.
He's in Toronto, Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, taking on the world.
Yeah, big spots.
Big spots. Okay, so you leave. That had to be a little frightening.
Terrifying.
Where do you go?
I started looking around. The neighborhood I'd been living in since I moved to New York was North Williamsburg, which was not the beautiful Brooklyn waterfront that it is now. It was dingy. So I lived in a dingy warehouse with a skateboard half pipe in the living room. And like there was no heat or air conditioning, but it was like $300 a month. So right. That was okay. And that's where I'd been living. And it was the neighborhood that I had grown to know. And so when it came time for me to start spending my own money and you know.
So you knew leaving Dave that you wanted to spend your own money.
I knew that I had to, yeah.
Yeah, you wanted your own place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because not every cook wants that, especially when you've watched the perils.
That's true. I think we all say that we want it, and some of us really just want it more than others.
And what percentage, when you have your own, is management / business person versus artistic, talented chef?
Well, I learned in the opening that I don't ever want to do anything by myself again. It's terrifying.
So you were opening by yourself?
I opened by myself. I opened completely by myself. I hired a front-of-the-house guy, and he was running service, and he was helping me like cover some of the business aspects of it. But yeah, there's, you know, I basically built the place out myself because I used to build houses when I was in Texas. So I have, you know, pretty good, you know, all-around general carpentry and GC skills. So built my own place, ran through all the rigmarole of SLA and DOB and
did you
ECB.
Get loans from them?
No.
I thought you meant small business.
The State Liquor Authority.
Oh,
Department of Buildings.
Yeah.
Department of Health. It goes on. There's a long list.
Okay. We have a restaurant at the school.
I know. So I was running all that stuff, and then got to the kitchen part and running the kitchen, and it's you know, it's just a lot for one person to carry.
It is. How much fun was making the menu?
Not as much fun as it should have been.
Why?
Just because when you're trying to open a place like that, when you're trying to like open by yourself without any help, which is very stubborn, you wind up having to spend a lot of time doing things that are distracting from that aspect of it.
Right. And you're looking at the price points,
right.
And you get very tempered.
Yes,
and,
this is true.
Okay, so the name of your first restaurant was?
The Brooklyn Star.
Oh, the Brooklyn Star. Oh, okay, so you did you go directly from Somme to?
No, after Somme, I consulted on a bar in the West Village with Ken Friedman in that group called The Restaurant.
So you had a few. You didn't jump right in.
No. I kept myself busy for a while. My friends also own Wilfie and Nell in the West Village, and I did a menu for them. And one of the brothers I wound up opening with years later, Simon, he's my current partner at the Brooklyn Star.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I did a little stuff to keep me busy while I fiddled.
While you fiddled, yeah. And when did you leave Sambor?
Let's see. I would have been in 2008.
2008, so it's about 6 years. All right, so we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to really get into Brooklyn Star and what makes it a star.
So far, support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Listening to Chef Story, and I want to thank Andrew White. I love his guitar playing from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Anyway, today I'm really excited because we're talking to Joaquin Baca, who has is the chef owner of Brooklyn Star right here in Brooklyn, New York. And we just heard his fascinating and worldwide journey to getting to be now the responsible one at the restaurant. Ooh. And the one that everybody, you've got all these people paying their rents and their mortgages based on you and your success of that restaurant. And in 2009, you opened in 2007?
In 2009.
2009. And you had a fire.
Yeah, it was open for approximately nine or 10 months. The original space was about 4 or 5 blocks from where I am now. In this little, similar size to original little bar space.
How many seats?
It's about 28 to 30 seats.
Okay, so it was like the original little bar.
And that's, I think, that was not exactly, not on purpose. Mm-hmm. So I was definitely trying to get back to that mm-hmm. feeling. Mm-hmm. The place had a 100-something-year-old wood-burning brick oven, which, so when you walk in, aside from every other mess that was in there, that's all I saw.
Uh-huh.
And it's beautiful. It's an amazing thing to work with. It's the very old Italian neighborhood. It was one of the original bakeries in the neighborhood, and so it's got a lot of history.
How big was the oven?
It is, well, they basically took what was a garage size, like a 1-car garage size bread oven, and domed it in. So it's a pizza size, pizza shaped dome oven. It's about 9 foot in diameter. So
wow.
it's a good size.
Yeah. So that was what you fell in love with.
That was a tremendous amount of fun to work with.
And you were already writing the menu when you saw it.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Everything's wood fired and tastes like smoke, and it's tremendous. And it's these great long paddles moving meats in and out, that's the first thing that starts to get rolling.
Okay, so at Salmon Noodle, where you spent most of your time, it was Asian inflection. What was going on in your mind for Brooklyn Star?
Brooklyn Star was, I guess, my chance to do what was kind of near and dear to me in a less filtered fashion, mm-hmm. which was, I mean, when we were at Momofuku was everybody's kind of love of what they knew, filtered through a sort of an Asian ingredient mm-hmm. more than palate, but so there were already Southern influences and Italian influences in the menu. We just put Asian ingredients to cover that up. But Brooklyn Star was more of a chance to kind of get back to what is near and dear to me, which is pretty much like very old American, not new American, old classic American stuff.
Define that for me, because you're from the Southwest.
Right, I'm from the Southwest.
So what is old American?
Old American, I mean, this country is rife with a history of its own. Mm-hmm. And the New World was the bounty. It's the everything amazing about produce and fish and fowl. And there is a lot of, I think it's more considered family style, and it's considered low class cuisine that is largely not by everyone. It's not as pretty.
So is it rice? Is it lobster?
It's rice and grains and lobster. Honestly, it's very difficult for anyone to narrow down, for most people to narrow down what exactly their cuisine is that they serve. The only thing I can tell you is that it is old classic American cuisine,
okay,
family
style. Give me some of the dishes that were on your menu.
Well, kind of went with a solid base of the things people expect: braised collard greens, a lot of ham hocks, a lot of pig product, mac and cheese, and stuff like that. And squash casseroles and tomato salad, stuff like that.
Down home cooking.
Maybe that's a good definition.
Yeah, maybe that's it. So, tell me about the fire, and tell me, how does that devastate you?
The fire was on a Thursday night at about 9 o'clock during a dinner service.
During dinner?
Yeah, my mom and wife were in for dinner. They were just sitting near the door, which was good. Smoke started to billow out of the walls. There was a faulty old flue that ran between the oven and the old brick chimney that I guess had just been simmering for a while, and it just hit its combustion point.
Oh my God.
We wound up with the upstairs apartment lady. Her apartment wound up in our kitchen.
Gosh.
It was a pretty good fire.
Everybody get out okay?
Everybody got out fine. Nobody was hurt. We that's the most important thing, of course. But
so then what does that do to you as a business person?
And it makes you reevaluate some things for sure. Mm-hmm. But if at that point you're so all in that there's not really an option. You're not really thinking, well, I'm going to go into real estate. This is what I do. And the only thing that you're thinking is, okay, like, how do we get past this? First of all, let's make sure everybody's taken care of. First thing we did the very next day, we got our checkbook out and wrote every check to every purveyor that we owed anything to.
Good for you.
Down to the dime, wound up with just a couple hundred bucks left in the bank account, but
oh my
that was
gosh.
Fine. We were felt happy. We made peace with the landlord, and he and I started to go forward on all of our insurance stuff. I'm not clever enough to try and cheat the IRS or insurance, so everything was very legit. Everything was on the books. It was very easy to deal with that aspect of it.
Good.
And there was sort of a long process. And in the meantime, the only thought was, how soon can we get back open? And how can we try and keep the people that are here?
How long did it take you?
It took a full, in the meantime, I had started talking to my friend Simon, who is, I told you before, one of the brothers that owns Wolfie and Nell.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs a tremendous bar. He's one of my favorite people on the planet. And we decided that we were going to do something together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the landlords from the neighborhood had approached me after the fire and said, listen, I got this place. It's not doing very well. These guys I can feel like they're about to bolt. I want you to take a look at it. I really like the way that you run your business and what I have in this place is this kind of janky, loud bar, and it's not good for my neighborhood. And I don't want this kind of thing going on in my neighborhood, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I like you and I trust you and I think that you should open in this place. Great. I mean, that's a dream, right?
You get right.
The landlord comes to you. It's fantastic. So we go and we look at this place and it's five times the size of what we were operating in.
100 seats.
108. Full bar, massive downstairs prep kitchen. And the first reaction was, no, I just want my little mom and pop spot. But it's kind of hard not to accept those kind of big toys. So with the original place, I partnered up with the Roberta's guys and this kid Frankie Pinello, who's from Bensonhurst. He's born to make pizzas, and we set him up and started running a pizza shop in there. It took us about, I think, 8 to 10 months to get through all the insurance stuff and then to rebuild.
And pizza has a good margin, right?
Sure, it's got a great margin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that place was best suited for that to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to fit
so
a square
what happened
peg into
to the
round
oven
hole.
Did you take it with
nope,
you
it's there it, well it's not the kind of mobile thing.
Yeah.
And everything got modernized to fit it back properly to the chimney, and it's running like a champ, and that's best pizza in that shop, and I'm still a partner there with Frank, and it's a great little business. It's a great little neighborhood spot.
Wow.
And we're pretty happy the way it's coming out.
So tell me about Brooklyn Star today. Well, describe it for people. Make their mouth water.
Okay, well, we set it up in what is supposed to be a very family-style atmosphere. It's kind of a big banquet hall sort of place. Me and my buddy Mike built all the tables out of these bowling alley floors from Flushing
really?
Bowling lanes. Yeah, so it's great big tables. It's very kind of loud and boisterous, I think.
I bet you could slide the condiments really easily on the table.
Yes, you actually can. and what happened there was sort of what happened when when Noodle Bar took off. We were brought in like the right group of people, and it started to grow into that thing where it wasn't just me trying to lead a couple of guys. It became again like that kind of like cohesive bunch, and that's I guess what I had originally been going for, and then now we're kind of like hitting that stride. So. My two sous chefs right now are one from North Carolina and one from Virginia, so everything does wind up having a little bit of a southern flair to it. But
mm-hmm.
We are doing like a lot of big meats, a lot of.
Now, when you say big meats, it's big joints of meat that you're cooking,
like
you're cooking?
40-ounce T-bones and whole braised pork shanks, wild boar ribs.
How do you cook them?
We had this really clever metal guy down the street build this smoker box that fits on top of our grill, so we're able to treat things in there for a long amount of time during prep. It's a big kitchen. We have a proper meat roast station, and it's
how many people grill. Now in your kitchen?
We run on a busy night with six line cooks.
So how do you manage them? Is it back in the old David style? Is there no pyramid?
There is no pyramid. We run it as a group. And obviously somebody has to be in charge.
Right.
And I guess that has to be me.
Yeah.
But I've been fortunate enough. And, you know, these things go through ebb and flow, of course. As you change staff, the dynamic changes a lot. Mm-hmm. Our initial opening staff at the New Star was sort of... how can I say this? It was a little scatterbrained. Mm-hmm. We're a little bit more focused now. We started out just like really excited and kind of, you know, just kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what stuck. And it got a little out of hand, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Probably frustrating for some, but now it's gotten to a point where we have a really good, basic staff, really good solid team, and menu development goes a lot more.
If you could do it over again, what wouldn't you do?
Life in general?
I know.
The Brooklyn Star.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Star.
Honestly, I can't really think of anything I wouldn't do. It's everything. Every mistake is something that you're not going to do again. And I feel like the more of them I get out of the way, the less you have for the long stretch.
It's called the School of Hard Knocks.
Right? That's what it is. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Well, that's a great way to look at it, to learn from your mistakes.
Staying in school for a while.
Yeah, I know. You don't want to stay there too long. Yeah. Dreams. What's next?
Dreams. You know, there's actually a couple of things in the pipeline. Neither one of us I can be too specific about because they're not really set in stone.
Ooh, but what, top secret.
Yeah, well, not like that. I just don't want to hex anything.
Yeah.
There's one that's in a different borough and one that's in a different country. I'll look at that far.
Ooh.
Which both are really could be really great.
That's so great. Well, hey, what do you think of the Food Network and all of that? Do you think a chef has to go down? What do you have to do for publicity? How much do you have to get out there and pimp yourself, you know?
I would like to do it as little as possible. I would rather spend my time in a kitchen than spend it wearing makeup on a talk show. Yeah, on a talk show. I think Food Network and all that stuff, it's fun for people. But I think it gives people a little bit of a misconception about what the real world is of working in a restaurant is. I think it like over glamorizes and stylizes it, where you get young people and career changers, the new into the field that are really taken by surprise. They come to expect a more pristine and respectful and stylish environment than it really is, and it's tough. I mean, it's very hard work.
Let me ask you about that, because Andre Soltner, who was the revered chef that had Lutèce, that was sort of a temple of gastronomy, when Tony Bourdain first came out with Kitchen Confidential, they serialized it in the New Yorker magazine, and Andre read it in the New Yorker, and I told him he should read the book, and he said, "I'm not reading that book." I said, "Why?" And he said, "The way he writes about our profession is, is very disrespectful." And I said to him, "You know, that's true, Andre, from your perspective, because of the way of the respect that you have and the discipline in your kitchen." I said, "But in the places Tony's been,
with respect to both, they're completely different.
They're completely different. So there are some environments that do have." If you walked into Jean-Georges' kitchen or Danielle's kitchen,
you're absolutely right.
Right, it's a different environment. So just not to put out there that all of the restaurants have this, you know.
No, I'm not saying it's a pirate kitchen.
Pirates, I like that. I never used that.
You didn't use that accent,
haven't you? I'm gonna say the Joaquin Bacca.
I'm just saying that, I mean, every trail that comes through the kitchen, every extern, whatever, I tell them the same thing. I say, "That's great. You like this? This is fun for you? Well, whatever you do, go and trail somewhere else. Go and trail everywhere that you can, because New York is great for that. There is every type of kitchen that you might be interested in working in, and they are all so different. And you just kind of have to find out where you fit."
That's right. It's very cultural. It's just like the food on the plate. You can have a roast chicken. Every restaurant has a roast chicken, but everyone is different.
Right. You just have to find out what it is that you actually want to do, and just find that place, because they're out there. No matter what kind of kook you are, there's a spot you'll fit in.
So when you have your own restaurant, does it feel like your home?
It is my home.
It is your home. Yeah. Well, believe it or not, we've done it. I mean, the show is coming to a close. Oh. And I have to say, it's really been a lot of fun talking to you, but you're going to get an award for best voice. Oh. You have the best radio voice of any of my guests, so, you know.
I was thinking about maybe starting a late night jazz.
I was going to say, you know, NPR, you should talk to the people here at Heritage Radio, because, you know, you got the voice, you got the story, and thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you
today.
So much for having me.
You're very welcome. And I just want to have a shout out to my producer, Jack Inslee, and Robin Cohen. Thank you so much for the help, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.